The 80s were a cultural heyday. The TV shows, the products, the movies, the fashion. It was all bold, brash, and bigger than life. But our guest this hour says the 80s mean a lot more to us than a compendium of pop culture references should. He says the 80s have pretty much provided the narrative for how we understand politics, the 60s, the military, and American culture. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm happy to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. Our guest this hour is David Sirota, journalist, nationally syndicated newspaper columnist, radio host, and author. His most recent book is Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. And as always, we welcome your phone calls this morning. Do you think we're reliving the cultural script from the 80s? Does Alex P. Keaton live on? You can ring us up at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And David Sirota, so glad you could join us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm thinking about the 80s, and they seem at first blush to be this almost cartoony decade. Everything was there's a hideous fashion, there were the cheesy sitcoms, they're so easy to make fun of, even though there's so much great pop culture there. What made you want to dig deeper in the 80s and look for something bigger?
Well, I'm a child of the 80s. I was born in 1975, so I was really culturalized in the 1980s. And one thing that struck me for really, especially recently, but for years, is that no matter where you are in America, you can basically turn on a television now and find an 80s movie on there or an 80s television show. You can find common ground with people by making 80s references. And I started asking the question, why is this? Why does this decade seem to endure so much more so than so many others? And when I started looking at that, I started finding that it wasn't just that the products are memorable. It wasn't just that we have an affinity for nostalgia. It's that the 1980s, really a lot of the stories that we started telling ourselves in the 1980s, a lot of the narratives that we started telling ourselves are still the stories and narratives that we tell ourselves today. And, of course, that's a deeper point. But, I mean, you can still see the 1980s everywhere. I mentioned to a friend a couple days ago, it was 25 years ago, almost to the week, that the country, that the world was watching the United States bomb Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, and the world was gripped with fears about a nuclear meltdown at Chernobyl. And I say that not because the past is always prelude, but I say that to suggest that it's a good indicator of how we are still not only telling ourselves the same stories as we started telling ourselves in the 1980s, but largely we're still facing many of the same problems, many of the same challenges that we faced in the 1980s.
What do you think made the 80s so formative then? Why did that decade, of all the decades, have such power to shape our cultural attitudes?
Well, I think that part of it has to do with the media at the time. The 1980s was the first decade where we saw a total pervasiveness of multimedia in our homes. That it was the first decade that a majority of Americans had television, cable, a VCR, and a plurality had some form of game system, video game system. So there was a media saturation in our homes that were able to immerse us in multimedia in a way that we had never been immersed before. On top of that, you had some very serious media and corporate consolidation, where by 1983, 50 companies controlled most major newspapers, television stations, movie studios, and the like. So that allowed for an integration of selling us the products that were sold in the 1980s, and through those products, the narratives. As I say in the beginning of the book, E.T., if you look at the movie E.T., a lot of that movie is a children's movie about how kids cannot trust, and in fact they have to run away from, the government. And we can talk about how the 80s sowed many of those anti-government themes, but in the 1980s it was the first time where a production like that could be found not just in the movie theater, but in your Happy Meal, on your lunchbox, in your cereal, on your Atari game system. So I think the 1980s, we were a tabula rasa in terms of multimedia, and it was the first time that multimedia was able to really reinforce these narratives, these memes, for the first time.
Don't you think it's true that popular culture in general recycles itself, though, just the way fashion does? And maybe we're just seeing the 80s come back because it's been a little while, and we might be due for, I don't know, some looks from the 30s, some tropes from the 30s. What do you think about the 80s that would make it more ripe for that?
Well, you know, I think there is something to that, right? I mean, the remaking of Karate Kid, for instance, and making the A-Team into a movie, sure, a lot of some of that is just Hollywood laziness. Those are old brands that are being recycled. But I also think that one of the reasons why the 80s endures is because we haven't really left the 1980s. And if you look at specifically some of the storylines I'm talking about, I mean, we are, for instance, dealing right now with a question in our domestic politics of the value of the government. And what is the value of the government? Is the government valuable at all? And a lot of what came out of 1980s pop culture, and by the way, reinforced, of course, by Reaganite political culture, was that you can't trust the government, was that the only people inside government that you can trust are the rogues, are the so-called mavericks. So that's just one example. I mean, we can talk about militarism as well. At the beginning of the 1980s, we were questioning, 50% of Americans were questioning the centrality of the military in our society, according to Gallup's polls. By the end of the decade, 85% of Americans were saying that the military was the most respected and revered institution in the society. So that was a major change there. You can also look at changes in terms of what we equate to the American dream. What is the American dream? The 1980s, if you look at surveys of college freshmen, at the beginning of the 1980s, many college freshmen were saying that they were going to college to get a philosophy of life. By the end of the 1980s, and of course, this is the way it's been ever since, most college freshmen say that their top goal for going to college is to make a lot of money. So my point here is that, yeah, there's a lot of recycling of old brands, for sure. But the reason why these brands are particularly trenchant right now, the greed is good idea, militarism from G.I. Joe and the like, narcissism, is because they are so relevant to our politics now, because the 1980s hasn't really ever really ended.
Hmm. So we're stuck in sort of a Groundhog Day rerun of the 80s, you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, and I think it's really, you can really see it in so many different places. I mean, I think you can definitely see it, as you mentioned in the beginning, how we think about the 1950s and the 1960s. This is the first chapter in my book, which is all about how the 1980s really redefined what the quote-unquote 50s and what the quote-unquote 60s mean to us right now.
And you're saying it wasn't a straight-up replication of the 50s, the actual 50s. You're saying that in the 80s we reimagined the 50s, we kind of packaged it, and that's what we bought into.
That's exactly right, that there's a 1950s that actually happened, and then there's the quote-unquote the 50s, which was created, really a cultural production created in the 1980s. And it was through everything from movies like Back to the Future, the idyllic 1950s, a kid fleeing into the idyllic 1950s, to rockabilly music, to Happy Days. There was a very big effort to create this memory of the 50s. At the same time, there was an effort to create a memory of the 1960s as a time not necessarily of social progress, not a time of stopping a destructive war, but a time of pure chaos, a time of decadence. You see this, I mean, one of the most famous 80s shows is Family Ties. Who hasn't seen Family Ties, lived through the 80s? Family Ties is comedy, is based around the son, the more conservative son, making fun of his parents' 60s liberalism. These are the same ideas that we are still struggling with in our politics today. The Tea Party folks are constantly making reference to wanting to take America back to the 1950s. And our presidential politics are constantly about the Democratic politicians' supposed connection to the 1960s. You saw that with John Kerry, saw it with Bill Clinton, you saw it with Barack Obama, them trying to connect them to Bill Ayers. So these are the same fights that we are still having over and over and over again.
Well, you mentioned Family Ties and the iconic character, Alex P. Keaton. And just to refresh our memories, we have a clip here from Family Ties.
Alex, don't you ever worry about the fact that there are enough bombs in the world to destroy every living creature and wipe out life as we know it?
Hey, I got bigger things on my mind. Can I use the business section here, Mom?
Thanks. Then we can just tell Matt he's one of the neighbor children.
It's just so predictable, that's all. Every time one of these ex-hippies comes prancing in from yesteryear, we gotta get out the love beads. Put on the ponchos. Pretend we care about people.
A clip there from Family Ties, one that you reference in your book. And as you tell, one of the interesting things about Family Ties is that it wasn't intended to be all about this conservative throwback character, Alex P. Keaton. It was supposed to be more about the whole family and also the political stances of the parents, wasn't it?
That's right. It was originally conceived of as a show about the parents, former hippies who were now raising a family and struggling with whether to pursue or whether to discard their 60s ideals. And what's fascinating is that in my interview with the creator of Family Ties, he said, you know, what we found upon testing the show was that the audience was most obsessed with, really loved Alex P. Keaton, the character of Alex P. Keaton. And of course, some of that's that Michael J. Fox is just a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
But it also reflects the zeitgeist of the time, where you put this in the context of Ronald Reagan berating the 60s. A guy who was coming up at that point, who was the president at that point, but had a long history of berating the hippies. You put that with a lot of the coming home from Vietnam movies, which were a lot of them were about how people supposedly spit on the troops. The hippies supposedly spit on the troops when they came home. All of these tropes came together to say essentially that the 60s were bad. The 60s were a joke. The 60s weren't about progress. And this is the same paradigm that we are still looking at our politics and really our culture through today.
And what about Ronald Reagan? He was the grand old gentleman presiding over the 80s. He was wildly popular to a lot of Republicans and other people. How does he fit into that?
Well, I think what's interesting is that we have some sociological research now that says that we've discovered since the 1980s that fact and fiction are as compelling, as formative in people's views about their world together. That entertainment products are just as formative to people's views as what they see on the news. And I would argue that this melding of entertainment politics and news really was embodied by Ronald Reagan. Here was a guy who was an actor, who came out of the popular culture world. Here was a guy who was constantly making reference in serious presidential speeches to movie lines. I mean, he's saying when he was talking about national defense, the force is with us. He made a reference in a State of the Union speech to Going Back to the Future. He made a reference to the Rambo movies when he was talking about the hostage situation. So Ronald Reagan really was a symbol of how politics and popular culture were starting to mix in the 1980s. And of course, today you have obvious examples. I'm Sarah Palin, her reality show. And I'm not making a value judgment on it, but I think that Reagan fit into this in two ways. He was reinforcing many of the same ideas that were in the popular culture of the time. The ideas, for instance, of going rogue, the government is evil, that you can see in shows like The A-Team, Knight Rider, Dukes of Hazzard. And he was also, showing that there was less of a distinction between that pop culture and our politics.
I guess what I don't get is why you think the 80s would have had such staying power, because we've had that kind of intense media saturation for 20 years past the 80s. What is it about the 80s that makes it stick then?
Well, I think I focus in on the idea that we were a tabula rasa at that point, right? I think a lot of us now know that we have 20, 30, 40, 100 channels on our television. We are used to being immersed in the media culture that we're used to being immersed in. But in the 1980s, it was really the first time, right? It was the first time that we were immersed in a multimedia culture of movies, TV, cable, video games, toys that were synergized. As I said, you didn't see Mr. T, for instance, just in the A-Team. You saw him in he was an action figure and he was a cartoon and he was a cereal. So I think there was that, and I also think there's just the point that we are now living in a world where the 80s children have grown up and are in our world-shaping positions of the moment, right? I mean, the people who are shaping our media today, the people who are shaping our politics today, all of us who grew up in the 1980s are now in those culture-shaping positions. And what do we draw on in our culture? We draw on, in many ways, what we learned as children.
So you're saying, and this might be kind of a a funny example, but it's sort of like the chicken who hatches and the first thing it sees is its mommy. You're saying we were kind of impressed upon in the 80s in a way that we were never able to erase afterwards.
That's right. I mean, you look at data, for instance, about how much TV people were watching at the in the late 1970s versus how much they were watching and how much media they were exposed to by the mid-1980s, and it's astounding how much time we started to spend immersed in that media culture. And that media culture, again, reinforces these narratives, reinforces these stories that tell us, to tell children in particular, how to see their world. A great example for that I came upon was The A-Team. I mean, here's a show that was all about the good guys fleeing the government, fixing the problems of society where the government couldn't or wouldn't fix. This was a show that was the most popular show among preteens, among kids 2 to 11 years old. And it was one of the most popular shows in America as well. If you put a child, if you expose a child to those messages, and one point I want to make too is that especially among children, children can't differentiate as well between political messages and non-political messages. So if you embed political messages, very, very ideological and political messages in entertainment culture focused at children, because they don't have that filter, those messages, that lens that you're showing them the world through, they're going to carry that forward.
So if what you're saying is true, then this phenomenon you're talking about, it has a natural shelf life, doesn't it? Because once you get to the next generation, say the millennials, the 80s don't mean anything to them.
Well, I'd like to believe that, but I don't think it's true, because I think we haven't yet seen in many ways, especially on the major subjects that I cover in my book, militarism, racism, narcissism, greed is good. We haven't yet seen, I don't think, a counter-narrative to what the 80s taught us. I think a lot of our politics, a lot of our popular culture is still playing within those 1980s storylines. And I don't think we've seen, I mean, as I say in the beginning of the book, before the 1980s, there was at least much more of a we're all in this together ethos in our media, in our political culture. The 1980s was, for instance, a time where it was everybody for themselves. It was the power of the individual. I would argue that we haven't seen any really major narratives, whether in our media, whether in our political discourse, that fundamentally challenges those 1980s narratives in a way that really changes the direction of the stories that we tell ourselves.
Well, we're talking this morning with David Sirota. He's a journalist, nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist, radio host, and author. We're talking about his new book. It's called Back to the Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. And we're opening the phone lines for your phone calls now. Do you agree with David Sirota? Are we reliving the cultural script from the 80s? And if we are, what's the cost? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, keeping you company this Tuesday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with guest David Sirota this morning about his book, Back to the Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now. And here's something you'll remember from the 80s.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your phone and call the professionals. Go
Ghostbusters!
Our courteous and efficient staff is on call 24 hours a day to serve all your supernatural elimination needs.
We're ready to believe you.
Clip, obviously, from Ghostbusters from the 80s, and they show up in your book. How do the Ghostbusters matter, David?
Right, that was a commercial for the Ghostbusters. What are they saying? They're saying that they're willing to listen to you, they're willing to believe you, where the government, where law enforcement is not willing to believe you. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of the Ghostbusters, don't get me wrong, but if you actually look at what the Ghostbusters is saying, it's really, really profound. And remember, this is one of the most popular movies, popular brands of the 1980s. And what it's saying is that is that the movie is saying you can't trust the government. In fact, the part of the storyline of the movie is that the government is the one that releases the ghosts into New York City. You can't trust the government. The government can't prevent this situation with ghosts taking over New York. You've got to hire the private contractor. And part of the comedy of the movie is how much money they're making, how they are a for-profit company. And the analog to this, of course, is the entire way we look at government right now. I mean, we're now in a decade into the idea of the private is the one who is most important to our security. I think by last count in Iraq, for instance, there was for every one public government worker, aka soldier in Iraq, there was one private contractor. And again, I don't want to say that the Ghostbusters is the reason we have Blackwater, for instance. But what I'm saying is sort of a larger point is that the Ghostbusters epitomize a story that we saw in all sorts of cultural products in the 1980s that I think desensitized us to the politics it represents. So that when you hear, oh, we're hiring this many private contractors to secure Iraq, or we're hiring this many private contractors to do airport security. Children of the 80s don't necessarily say, hey, wait a minute, is that a really radical policy? Is that a really good idea? In part because so many of the cultural products they consumed and that they saw as regular and normal and even fun were telling the same story.
Hmm. Aren't we sucking all the fun out of the 80s, though? Can we still enjoy all this stuff now that you're telling us what's really there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Look, I think the what was disturbing for me in researching this book was thinking about how children of the 1980s weren't aware of what ideological messages were being packaged in the popular culture of the 1980s. But I think as adults, we can look back on all of this stuff and enjoy it, but put it in its right place. The goal of this book is not to say that the 80s wasn't fun. I mean, I remain a huge fan of 80s popular culture. The goal of this book is to make us aware that these were some of the messages embedded in this popular culture, and it's good to be aware of that to understand that when we're thinking about moving forward into the future as a society, it's good to know that part of our worldview is shaped by something, frankly, artificial. And that, I think, potentially opens up a space that we can say, hey, you know what? Even though I love the Ghostbusters, even though I love the A-Team, even though I love Dukes of Hazzard, maybe that's not maybe the story embedded in those products isn't the story I should be telling myself about the future of our country.
Well, I've got a bunch of folks waiting to talk to you here, so let's get to our phones. We have Rob joining us from Park Falls. Hi, Rob.
Good morning.
Morning.
Boy, this is one heck of a fascinating topic, and I've always been an admirer of Sirota's work. Well, one thing I'd like to say is, actually, there's a couple things I'd like to say. But first of all, I find it fascinating that that there's this idea that there's a kind of a natural cycle of pop culture defining the current age in which we live, and I think that we may be on the verge right now of entering, perhaps into a new phase. You know, if you look at the news around the Midwest and other places in the fight relative to collective bargaining and grouping, massive amounts of people grouping together for positive change, kind of an us against them mentality. If you look back in the 90s, the kids that were growing up in the 90s are now the people who are just now coming into their own, much in the way people my age were the folks in the 80s who came into their own about 10 years ago. And if you look at the popular characters in the 90s, people like Wolverine and the return of the Dark Batman and this sort of thing, where the characters are it's us against them, and I find it fascinating that we could be on the verge of seeing a new cycle take over. And the other thing I'd like to say is that the one thing that I take a little bit of task with Sirota's claim here, and I haven't read the book, but I'm going to, is the big difference is that we've got a massive amount of information available to us now that we didn't have in the 80s. You know, the advent of the internet and, as you mentioned before, you know, 200 different channels on the cable and satellite and whatnot. Don't you think that some of those somewhat vapid messages of the 80s can easily be combated just by the sheer amount of information that's out there?
Interesting, Rob. Thank you so much for your points.
Yeah, I think that's a profound point. I mean, I think that's a really profound point. I mean, look, if you can look across the news right now and you can see a lot of the 80s really screaming at us. As I mentioned before, it's the almost exactly to the week, the 25-year anniversary of both the U.S., the original U.S. bombing of Libya, and a nuclear meltdown, that one at Chernobyl. So you can see that, obviously, in the second bombing of Libya and the Japanese situation. You can also see it in the labor struggles right now in places like Wisconsin, right? I mean, I don't know about you, but it brings up to my mind, Governor Walker brings to my mind memories of Ronald Reagan sort of trying to stand down the unions as it related to the air traffic control.
Well, Governor Walker said that Reagan is one of his heroes, I think.
Exactly. So you can definitely see the 80s back in the news. You can see it in our culture. But I think Rob is right that the difference now, and this is why this book fundamentally is hopeful, is that a lot of the media I talked about in the book impacting us in the 1980s for the first time was most of it, really all of it, was top-down media. By that I mean it was broadcast to us. There wasn't interaction. It was a perfect instrument, therefore, to be a propaganda instrument because it was the television talking to you. It was the video game producers talking to you. It was the movie producers talking to you. It was a one-way street, and there wasn't really a way to talk back. The internet, I think, is obviously a two-way medium. You can put things on the internet. Things can come back to you on the internet. It's a much more interactive media, and I do think if there are things that can give us hope, that a lot of these 80s narratives will be challenged and perhaps modified. One of them is the rise of the internet that isn't a top-down propaganda tool.
Okay, well, thank you, Rob. And on to Brad from Plover. Hey, Brad.
Hey. By the 1980s, I think we forgot how we, as a society, dug out of the Depression and built the middle class. When Reagan became president, he purposefully cut taxes, knowing that it would create deficits, and then the Republicans could justify, oh, now we got to shrink government, we got to privatize government because we got these deficits. It was like a foregone conclusion that would happen, and that's continued on through today, with taxes still being at an all-time low and us having these endless huge deficits. Reagan also championed deregulation, union busting, and those philosophies have continued through today. And what we've also seen is a huge shift to the right in our politics, whereas the Democrats of today, they're offering up health care policies that are more conservative than Nixon or Bob Dole's proposals. And tax cuts under Obama are the lowest they've been in probably since before the Depression. And my last comment is some other characters I remember from the 80s would be like the Rambo character or the Chuck Norris character going into other countries and kicking butt. But I'd like David to comment on some of my comments.
Sure. Yeah, and what I would say is I think that you're definitely right about the politics of the 1980s and how they resemble today's politics in many ways, resemble an intensified version of the politics of the 1980s. And the question I think that I struggle with in the book is, who created the politics of the 1980s? Was it Ronald Reagan that created the politics of the 1980s, or did Ronald Reagan represent the politics, a larger cultural politics of the 1980s? And
right.
I think it's symbiotic. But I do think that you're right. When you look at today's politics, almost every policy is, you can still see through the lens of what was going on in the 1980s. I mean, I'll give you an example. You mentioned Rambo. One of the major things that we hear in politics all the time when it comes to ideas of war is that we have to let the troops win, right? That the commanders on the ground need to be making the decisions, not the politicians in Washington. Now, there's something extremely, I think, disturbing about that idea in the sense that one of the things that sets us apart from other nations is that our Constitution mandates civilian control of the military. But this idea letting them win came straight out of both Ronald Reagan and the Rambo movies. The very beginning of Rambo 2 is a whole discussion about Rambo asking his commander, are they going to let us win this time? And Ronald Reagan, when he was campaigning for a president in 1980 and when he discussed after that the Vietnam War, because a lot of the 80s militarism is rooted in reimagining the Vietnam War, a lot of what Ronald Reagan was saying is the troops weren't allowed to win. So we see this in our politics right now. When you see President Obama, for instance, not going to Congress even for an authorization to go to war in Libya, and him talking about how he is basically delegated, just like George Bush said, by the way, when it came to Iraq, that he's delegated tactical decisions and strategic decisions to military leaders, he's speaking to us in the narratives of the 1980s that says that politicians, the highest virtue of politicians when it comes to making war, is to simply allow the troops to do whatever they want. And this, so it endures in a way that it's almost hard to see unless you wake up to it.
And how do you suggest that happen?
Well, I think it happens because I think that there's a natural momentum when you have the synergy. For instance, when you have the synergy of a president saying that we lost Vietnam and we've lost previous wars because we didn't let the troops win, when you have that amplified by all sorts of back to Vietnam movies, all sorts of other cultural productions that are making the same case, you get a politics that typically tries to play within those narratives rather than create their own narrative.
How would you get the waking up you're talking about on a national scale?
Well, I think there's two ways. I mean, I think that for instance, you would expect at least some waking up when some of those policies inevitably go wrong. I mean, I think that even though we are still in a Tea Party moment, if you will, that I think the Wall Street meltdown made a lot of people fundamentally rethink whether the greed is good idea from the 1980s was really a good idea as a governing ethos. So I think real world events are slowly making us wake up to, hey, there may be another way. I mean, I think you look at polls on the Libya question, while the entire political elite is basically behind the Libya operation, most polls show that Americans have deep reservations about yet another war. So I think real-world events change attitudes, and I also think you'd like to believe that as those real-world events change attitudes, that some of the political narratives that politicians are operating on will change. I mean, you do see some progressive Democrats in the Congress saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't be going into Libya. And then on top of that, I think that a book like mine, I would hope, makes people realize when they read it that, and again, I'm a fan of 80s pop culture, but makes people realize that, hey, you know what? A lot of what we're doing right now is simply putting 1980s culture, the lessons that we learned in the 1980s, simply on loop. We're not learning from our experiences as much as we are basically replaying old ones.
Well, I want to thank Brad for his call and another call. Darren is next from Onalaska. Hi, Darren.
How's it going?
Going well. How about you?
I'm fine. Say, I think that the agent of socialization that's being talked about here is the media and how the media socializes, the culture which is in tune to that. However, that is just one agent of socialization. I think that it's a pretty far reach when we use just one of the agents of socialization to dictate that is somehow going to correlate to a mass movement by the society in the ways that they perform their job roles, 20 years later. I think that is, anecdotal at best. And I would think that any type of critical analysis of that type of research would bear out that there's very low correlation between what the guest is saying and the actual practice of the people that are engaged in it. We definitely need to look at other agents of socialization as means of explaining why people in their job roles perform the way they perform.
Well, what I would say to that is I think it's absolutely true that media, popular culture, And by popular culture, I don't mean just movies, TV, commercials. I'm talking about toys. I'm talking about video games. I'm talking about clothing. I'm talking about real world events in many ways, of political culture as it intersections with real world events. And my take is that yes, it's true. That's only one set of forces that account for socializing a society, but it's a very powerful one. And I would also say that a lot of what I do in the book is not make the argument that the media necessarily, that the popular culture necessarily shaped us unilaterally. It's that the popular culture of the time was also reflecting back to us a changing zeitgeist underneath. That when you talk to people, when you talk to, for instance, the guy who made Family Ties, he was saying, listen, the only thing we cared about was ratings. The only thing we cared about was succeeding at the Nielsen ratings. And in doing that, basically, what that means is shaping the media product around what the audience wants. So I think that what we can do is we can look back at the media and the popular culture of the 1980s as a symbol of how the society itself was changing. And then when you put that next to so much of the actual data, and a lot of my book has a lot of data in it about things that profoundly changed in the 80s among social attitudes and haven't changed back since. When you put those things together, I think what you see is that 1980s popular culture was both an agent of change and a reflection of the change that was already happening.
Well, tell us about some of the attitudes that changed in the 80s that haven't flipped back.
Sure. I mean, I think the Gallup poll, when you look at Gallup's poll of institutions, 1980, 50% of Americans expressed no confidence in the military. By the end of the 1980s, almost 85% of people said they had full confidence in the military, and it was the most respected institution in the society. That number has basically not changed back since that time. You look at a poll of college freshmen, as I mentioned before, in the beginning of the 1980s, many college freshmen were saying that they were going to college in order to develop a philosophy of life. By the end of the 1980s, a huge jump in the number of college freshmen who said their top goal was making a lot of money. That has not changed back. In fact, that's only become larger. So those are two for you. Obviously, when you look at people's attitudes about the government, what the government can do, what the government should be doing, the value of government, those numbers precipitously declining in the 1980s, and they've remained low ever since.
Our guest this hour, David Sirota. He's a journalist, nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist, radio host, and author. We're talking about his most recent book this morning. It is called Back to the Future, Back to Our Future, rather, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. And we're open to your questions and comments this morning. You can ring us up at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
GR3 goes on easy, stays on hard, makes your car beautiful, like me. GR3 fights off the enemies like dirt, sand, and grime. You want tough? This is tough. TR3, take it from me, Mr. T.
Clip, obviously, there, Mr. T, continuing his cultural cachet. We're talking with David Sirota this morning about his recent book. It's called Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. And we've got a lot of folks still waiting to talk, so let's go right to Mark from Door County. Hi, Mark. You're next.
I was wondering how he interprets the popularity of Star Wars. Was that sort of, because it had a theme kind of like, is that the little people working together can defeat the great big empire?
I think Star Wars is really important. Star Wars is important not just because of the story of Star Wars, which is in some ways, it depends on what you see the Empire as. If you see the Empire as the government, then it's, you know, the outsiders rising up against the government. So it depends on how you see Star Wars. I think that Star Wars, setting aside the story of Star Wars, if you look at it, how it impacted the rest of the cultural sphere, is really, really profoundly interesting. Star Wars, there was a whole debate about whether to include the word war in Star Wars. In the 1970s, there was some trepidation among studios because the public was, at that point, as I mentioned before, was really much more anti-war than it had ever been after the Vietnam situation. And so there was a debate about whether to keep the word war in Star Wars. Obviously, they ultimately kept it. But what ended up happening was is that Star Wars and then Empire Strikes Back, of course, in 1980 and Return of the Jedi, one of the things that I argue that Star Wars did was create a universe that technologized war, that said war could be a technologized, almost sanitized exercise. And Star Wars, this was followed along by G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe, one of the most popular shows among children, of course. I think there was a stat that said half of all American boys had a G.I. Joe figure at one point in the 1980s. Sales of war toys hit their highest levels since World War II in the 1980s. And what I argue is that, and a lot of the cultural producers followed Star Wars in presenting war as a technologized exercise. G.I. Joe was brought back as a kind of technologized product, as opposed to what it had been before, which was actual soldiers. There only used to be in the 60s four G.I. Joe figures that were actual soldiers. After the success of Star Wars and the success of Star Wars toys, G.I. Joe is resurrected as a technologized kind of bloodless endeavor, and this is directly tied to the success of Star Wars. So I guess what I'm saying in a roundabout kind of way is that Star Wars, whatever you believe about the story, Star Wars had a profoundly big impact on re-mainstreaming the idea that you could sell war toys, but they had to be a particular kind of war toy, a kind of war toy that sort of technologized and took the blood and guts out of war.
Which I guess is sort of what helped sell some of the Bush's early wars, the idea that you could get in and get out with no casualties.
That's exactly right. And I found this speech from Ronald Reagan, I think it was in 1983. He was speaking to students at Epcot Center, and he made a very, very profoundly prescient statement talking to students about space invaders. And he said that the game was training our future pilots for military combat. And he said this was a good thing, and he went as far as saying that the screen looks exactly like the screens in some of the new cockpits at the time. Obviously, the idea that war can be a purely technological and non-bloody endeavor carries with us today. When you look at the drone pilots, I mean, Ronald Reagan was almost literally predicting drone warfare. But it goes beyond drone warfare, as you suggest. The entire idea that we can fight wars with smart bombs, with technology in a way that doesn't appear as bloody as war really is. This continues to suffuse our politics today when we think about war. So much of what we are encouraged to think about is not the blood and guts consequences of war, but almost a glorified video game.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for bringing that up. And another call, Dave with us from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. I'd also add A-Team was pretty sanitized, too. But I wanted to bring up, in my senior year in 1982, my brother added a poster on his wall. We shared a room. Alongside his Farrah Fawcett poster, he bought a 6-foot poster that said, in big, bold letters, black background, big white letters, "He who dies with the most wins." And he ended up getting a T-shirt made of that, and he was just that thing stayed on the wall. I think he probably still has that poster, and I think it's just really relevant now.
Mm. It absolutely is, and this is exactly what Ronald Reagan was saying. This is exactly what movies were saying. Ronald Reagan gave one State of the Union speech calling CEOs, multimillionaire CEOs, heroes for the 80s. You look at some of the best-selling movies of the 1980s, The Secret to My Success, which is the message of that is the goal in life is not just to have a middle-class life, not just to have a good family, but to amass huge sums of wealth. You look at the TV of the 1980s, 1980s, the most popular TV shows, Dallas, Dynasty, Falcon Crest, all glorifying a huge accumulations of wealth. And I think this really has become, as you suggest, has become the norm, that when we think American Dream right now, we are encouraged to think becoming a Gordon Gekko. And I do hold out hope that perhaps that the recession and the Wall Street situation, the Wall Street meltdown, of course, I lament that that happened, but I do hold out hope that the silver lining in those two phenomena are that maybe our aspirations will change a little bit, that people's aspirations will change from that 80s aspiration to something more modest.
I want to read an email here from Sandy. She says, I'm so excited such a book has been written on this subject. I personally have for a long time thought this to be true. Now I'm concerned with all the reality TV shows in which winning happens not by honest competition, but rather by aggression and actually using your own benefit and actually using for your own benefit people that have been supportive of you. Double-crossing and abusiveness are being taught on these shows, and she thinks this is already being present and this sort of example showing up in the workplace and personal relationships and the political scene. What do you think about reality TV? Because isn't that really the product of the 2000s?
Reality TV is actually rooted in the 1980s. The first reality TV shows, there's actually a debate among pop culture enthusiasts about which of the first reality TV show. Was it Dance Fever and Star Search, or was it Cops? But those are both sets of 80s shows. So those are the first reality TV shows. I guess, you know, Dance Fever and the like, that's more American Idol. Cops is more of a straight-up reality TV show. And I think that what comes out of reality TV is this idea, and it's actually the meta point on what the emailer was saying. It says that the individual, that the achievement of the individual through any means necessary, even making oneself a spectacle, even double-crossing people on national television, that the individual achievement is what the ultimate virtue is among people. It is the antithesis of the we're all in this together idea. I mean, think about the people who are on reality TV. They are, what are they aspiring to? They are aspiring to fame for fame's sake. They're not carrying a message. They're not carrying any kind of political or ideological or social value message. It is pure voyeurism on the part of the audience, and it is the people on reality TV who are effectively saying that the way to succeed in America is to focus only on the individual to the point of being willing to make oneself a complete spectacle on television.
Another call here. John joining us from Greenfield. Hey, John.
Hey, I'm a student of the 80s as well. Glad to hear the show. A couple things. A couple of my favorite movies from the 80s are Working Girl and Secret of My Success, Working Girl with Melanie Griffith, Secret of My Success with Michael J. Fox. And I disagree with the idea that those movies are about greed. I just heard the guests say that it's about accumulating wealth. Secret of My Success is about breaking through and being individually accountable and breaking through the man and the system and using your head and using your brain. And so is Working Girl, you know, underdogs. And I think one of the themes out of the 80s is the individual can succeed despite odds against the individual, and I'd like your guest comment on that.
Okay, thanks, John.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think you can look at Secret to My Success in both ways. It's the power of the individual, but it's also what is the goal? What is the individual aspiring to? And again, it's the accumulation of great wealth. I would say, though, that I have a whole section in my book called The Jumpman Chronicles, and The Jumpman, of course, is the image of Michael Jordan soaring above everything else, that now iconic image. And I do think you're right. The 80s idea that the individual could soar above the team, that the individual was the ultimate power in the society, not the society, not we're all in this together, is a huge thing that comes out of the 1980s. And what's interesting is it comes out of a 1980s that came right after the era of movement politics, of solidarity politics, of the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the anti-war movement.
So we've just got about a minute left, David, and I wonder what you think we should be doing if we want to be conscious about what came out of the 80s. What should we be doing to make ourselves aware and make sure that history doesn't keep on repeating itself, I guess?
Well, I think it's quite simply is simply when you hear a politician speak, when you see a television show, the framework of a television show, your favorite television show, ask yourself what it's really saying. And in particular, ask yourself what it's saying to your children, and whether what it's saying to you and your children does carry a serious ideological message. Typically, it does. And so I think the key part here is to simply be aware that so much of what we're being told, what we're being sold, comes with embedded ideological messages, and that we've got to finely tune our filters to realize that political messages don't just come in political commercials. They also come in all sorts of other products as well.
Well, David Cerna, thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been great talking with you. It's a great book.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Cerna, a journalist, nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist, radio host, and author. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Back to the Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. And I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and also for answering your phone calls this morning, and also to Chrissy Pease for her production this week as well. And thank you for listening. Kathleen Dunn will be back with you next week, Monday. And in the meantime, I'll be keeping you company through this week. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.